Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. What's in a word, you ask? Oh, plenty, says the Federal Reserve. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 20th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The language of the Fed in a minute, but we are going to start today in the history might not repeat itself, but it definitely rhymes section of the broadcast, campaign finance edition. It's brought to us by the senator from Vermont, the once and present presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. You might remember back during the 2016 campaign, Sanders made much of his small dollar fundraising prowess.
Anybody here know what the average contribution is? That's right. $27.
Sanders announced yesterday that he is in for the Democratic nomination in 2020 and then announced this morning that within 24 hours, he had raised $6 million from 225,000 people, which works out to, when you do the math, yes, an average donation of $26.67 apiece. Senator Kamala Harris, a couple of weeks ago, basically the same thing, slightly less money, $1.5 million in the relative blink of an eye. All of which is to say, this is going to be an expensive race, and a long one, too, especially for the donors, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Campaign fundraising typically determines how much ad time a candidate can afford, how much staff they can hire. But this early in the race, the money is about positioning.
In a crowded field, one of the ways that these presidential hopefuls are distinguishing themselves is by demonstrating the breadth of their support.
Amy Allison is president of the political network She the People.
It's just a way to measure if the campaigns will be around long enough to see Labor Day this year.
And Democrats aren't the only ones making a statement with their opening numbers. President Trump hasn't stopped fundraising, and his $130 million campaign war chest sends its own message. Jennifer Nicole Victor is a political scientist at George Mason University.
One of the strategies he's trying to pursue there is to scare off an opponent who might seek to challenge him in a primary by showing how formidable he is as a candidate and as a fundraiser.
Highly coveted small donors have been turning out for both sides, and Victor says they're likely to keep giving what they can, prompted by emails, speeches, and news events. But for the big donors, folks who regularly give thousands of dollars,
they're going to be getting called repeatedly throughout 2019 and 2020.
Jennifer Heerwig is a political sociologist at Stony Brook University who studies political donors.
The large donors with such a wide Democratic field may start experiencing some fatigue with such a long race and so many candidates to potentially support.
Because those donors are probably on everyone's list. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We detour now to matters economic and linguistic. The Federal Reserve released the minutes of its most recent meeting today, the one at the end of January, at which Chair Jay Powell and his colleagues made it pretty clear they were willing to stop raising interest rates for a while, given some signs the economy might be slowing. That was a big change for the Fed, and we wanted to make sure we were reading the central bank's signals the right way, so we reached out to a professional for some help. Jessica Rett teaches linguistics at UCLA. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to read you a couple of things here, and then I need you to tell me what you, as a person who studies this stuff, what you think the Federal Reserve means, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. So at their meeting in December, and we're talking about this again because the meetings came out today from the January meeting, the most recent meeting. But back in December, the Federal Reserve said this about economic activity in this country. It said economic activity has been rising at a strong rate. Mm. OK, rising at a strong rate. And then in their meeting in January, They said economic activity has been rising at a solid rate. Can you help me understand what Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed are trying to do here?
So that sounds to me like a slight weakening. Strong is a positive evaluative adjective, so it suggests that we've got a positive judgment about what's happening. So if I have a student in a course and I say their progression is strong, then it suggests I feel positively towards that progression. On the other hand, solid progression, it's not necessarily a positive one. It could be something I'm not particularly happy about, but at least minimally, it's consistent. So the two adjectives focus on different components of the rise.
Yeah, and you could make the case that the Fed maybe is not so happy with the way things are going right now, hence the solid. Let me try another one on you here. Again, from the December statement, it was talking about interest rate increases this time. And the Fed said the committee judges that some further gradual increases in interest rates are going to be necessary. That was December. And now this past month in January, they said the committee will be patient as it determines what interest rates ought to be. Decipher that for me.
So that seems like some more subtle weakening in three respects. So the first one is a statement of the fact that they want some increases. But there's three sort of hedging or weakening components of the updated version. They're going to be patient as they determine what future adjustments to the target range may be appropriate. It says we're sort of not going to come down in a position of whether or not there's going to be a change and whether it'll be a increase or decrease. When you put all of these things together, it sort of amounts to the difference between the sentence, I know how much coffee Kai wants, which is a sort of straightforward declaration of what the facts on the ground are, versus I wonder whether Kai might want coffee, which is significantly more hedged and less informative. Man. So they know what they're doing over there.
Yeah, well, okay. So first of all, Kai definitely wants coffee. But second of all, they must spend an excruciating amount of time on this wordplay, and I don't mean that, in a pejorative sense, but clearly they're very intentional about literally the words.
Yeah, I'm actually a little impressed with the minutes. It seems as though they're sort of, they know what they want to do, and they know how to do it very subtly, which is more than I can say for a lot of us.
Well, yes. Do you think, actually, and this is a little bit sideways, and I don't know how closely you follow the business press, but do you think we spend too much time trying to do the Kremlinology of what the Fed is talking about?
Oh, goodness. Well, what else would we do with our time? I think reading tea leaves is fun, and they've given us a lot to work with here. So it sounds like a useful exercise to me.
Jessica Rett is an associate professor of linguistics at UCLA. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
On Wall Street today, a whole lot of bouncing around. Little net change, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. No pressure here, but it is something less than 2 months till taxes are due. A lot of people have filed already, of course, but a lot of them are none too happy. First of all, taxes. Also, though, because their refunds are down 9% on average from last year. That's according to the Internal Revenue Service. And it's interesting because most people actually got a net tax cut from the 2017 overhaul. To be clear here, if you got a refund, it means you gave the government too much money. You can avoid that by adjusting your withholding, how much your employer takes out of your paycheck and sends straight to the IRS. But people have come to love and count on their refunds. And as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains, so too has the rest of the economy.
Maybe you've seen this ad recently. It's from ATC Income Tax, based in Georgia. Three couples are sitting around a dinner table, and they're bragging about their tax refunds.
How much we talking? Four?
Ooh.
Five?
Ooh.
Seven?
That's more than we got, babe.
Oh, my God.
This is Justin McAuliffe. He's a CPA in Belmore, New York. To him, this ad represents everything that's wrong with the way we think about taxes.
Refunds aren't cool, right? Like, that's your money. They're making this seem that a refund is something magical. It's your money.
As McAuliffe is constantly telling his clients, and anyone else will listen, a refund is just money you overpaid in taxes. It is an interest-free loan to the government. It's also something the multi-billion dollar tax preparation industry uses as a selling point.
We're letting our clients walk away thinking that we're great because of the refund we get them. It's bull, it's garbage.
And yet, judging by the widespread dismay over what's happened to refunds this year, people have gotten attached to them. How did we get here? Let's go back to the early 1940s. The U.S. had just entered World War II, and the government needed money to fund the war effort. So Congress expanded the income tax. No longer was it only the really rich who had to pay.
I paid my income tax today.
The Treasury Department even commissioned Irving Berlin to write a song reminding people that paying taxes was their patriotic duty.
Tax I'm very glad to pay.
The government couldn't bank on patriotism alone, so it created withholding. Employers started deducting taxes from workers' paychecks and sending that money to the government. But the math was tricky, and by the late 40s, the government was giving back about $2 billion to taxpayers a year. The tax refund was born. And along with it, a huge marketing opportunity. Back then, Ed Garton's grandfather owned a car dealership in Hinton, West Virginia. And like a lot of car dealers, he was always coming up with gimmicks to get people in the door.
He actually gave away two ponies to two little girls who dragged their fathers in to look at the new 57 Ford.
So Garton, who's an auto historian, says the tax refund became yet another way to sell cars.
Dealerships were savvy, and they were essentially saying, we know you've got money coming to you soon, going to be jingling in your pocket. You probably need a new car.
By the 60s, all kinds of businesses were trying to cash in on refund season. Come spend your refund on a new couch or a color TV or a side of beef, 67 cents a pound. And along the way, refunds became a part of our lives. David Williams is chief tax officer at Intuit, which owns the tax preparation software TurboTax. He also spent years at the IRS.
I've yet to see anything that will dissuade taxpayers from wanting and demanding a significant refund.
Or it's like a birthday present, you know? Somebody sent you money.
Rachel Davies lives in Virginia, and yes, she knows the refund is her own money. But like nearly three quarters of taxpayers, she and her husband are happy to have the government hold on to that money for them. They get back a few thousand dollars every year.
I know it's not the best practice, and so it's hard to admit, but I'm not very disciplined with the money that's in the checking account.
Over the years, the Davies have used their refund to buy new tires and season passes to an amusement park. But they just did their taxes, and it turns out they won't get a refund this year. In fact, they owe money. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
If you want to see some of those ads or maybe read the sheet music from that Irving Berlin song about income taxes, we got them online, marketplace.org. There's news from Big Coal today, a decision by Glencore, the Anglo-Swiss mining conglomerate, that it's going to cap production at 150 million metric tons of coal a year, which is, it has to be pointed out, a little bit more coal than the company mined last year. But the announcement is a big deal, and it's a bit surprising, too, because Glencore has until now been bullish on coal, saying it would keep driving companies' profits, supplying developing economies in Asia. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains the 180.
Over the past few years, Glencore has been pumping up its coal mining operations, which short-term profit-wise has kind of made sense, says Costa Samaras at Carnegie Mellon University.
Demand is still very strong in India and in other parts of the world. Last year, coal shipments were more than a billion tons for the first time ever.
So why is Glencore now pulling back?
They're responding to institutional investors, looking at the writing on the wall and seeing increased risk from assets that won't be viable in a low-carbon world that has increased appetite to deal with climate change.
These are long-term financial risks, like increased regulation that favors renewable energy. Also, climate change lawsuits against fossil fuel companies. In the long run, Adele Morris at the Brookings Institution says market players are signaling
the grim outlook for coal reflected in no new investment in coal-fired power plants. They expect eventually to have their greenhouse gas emissions curtailed.
Meanwhile, Glencore's plan to cap coal production could have an upside for some U.S. producers that want to ship more to Asia, where demand is still strong, says Ian Lang at the Colorado School of Mines.
You know, this is good news for them, as if they can get to that Pacific market, they might have less competition.
But that won't be easy. New coal export terminals need to be built in coastal states like California and Washington, where opposition based on the risk of further damage to the climate is strong. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the same kinds of asthma triggers that exist in homes also exist in daycare centers.
And cleaning them up ain't cheap. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 63 points today, about 0.25%, 25,954. The NASDAQ gained 2 points. That's less than 0.1%, 74.89. The S&P 500 moved up 4 points, about 0.1%. 27.84. Mitchell Hartman was telling us about Glencore. Shares up 2.5% today. Samsung announced the new Galaxy Fold phone today. The screen folds in half and works like a tablet when unfolded. Shares of Korea-based Samsung are not easy to buy in the United States. It doesn't trade on American exchanges, but you can get the new Galaxy starting in April. But get this, price tag almost $2,000. As for Samsung's biggest competitor, Apple, shares up 0.6% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Two items with which to begin this next story. Number one, it was 30 degrees with sleet and freezing rain in Washington today. Number two, though, the Washington Nationals and the rest of professional baseball have been in spring training for a week or so, a sure sign that springtime will eventually be upon us. But Major League Baseball as a business has been having a bit of a rough go. Attendance is down and games, come on, they kind of drag. But according to a new report by the Sports and Fitness Industry Association, baseball participation is actually growing. Rachel Bachman covers sports for the Wall Street Journal. She wrote about that study today. It's good to have you on.
Great to be here, Kai.
I kind of can't believe I'm saying this, given the problems that Major League Baseball is having with attendance and interest and all of that. But certainly down lower in the programs, it's hot. What's going on?
Baseball participation is up overall about 21% in the last 4 years. This is a surprise to people who have seen all the critics pelting MLB for sagging attendance and games that seem to never end.
How is baseball doing this? First of all, let's stipulate here, it's a conscious thing. It's an organized thing that Major League Baseball is trying to do here.
That's right. In 2015, along with USA Baseball, the governing body of the sport in the U.S., MLB launched a program called Play Ball. And the idea was just simply to get as many kids as possible playing the game, even if it was just throwing a wiffle ball around at a park. They have had a bunch of events all over the country. And lo and behold, the numbers started to climb.
Do we know how much Major League Baseball is paying to make all this happen?
You know, I don't know that, but I have to say that they seem very pleased with the results. The ranks of kids who just play baseball a little bit, you know, like a handful of times a year, grew 53% in the last 4 years. And if they can convert even a tiny fraction of those to, you know, signing up for leagues and becoming lifelong fans, I would say that's money well spent.
Yeah, so that's casual player growth, right, based on this study. What about this thing called frequent player growth?
Yes, that's much smaller. That's about 5% over 4 years. That's, you know, kids who are generally signed up for leagues most likely. And, right. you know, that's the harder thing to crack, but that's also the area where a lot of other sports are falling off. And so the fact that baseball is gaining even incrementally in those right. core players is really notable.
Get it back up to the major leagues for me, right? Because, and look, I go to a couple of Dodger games a year and it's fun and all, but honestly, 3+ hours for 9 innings of baseball is kind of a snoozer. Is baseball doing anything to get the actual professional game more attractive?
Well, I know they've made some tweaks to try to speed up the game, and that is an ongoing challenge. And, you know, an open question is how much sports betting might affect interest in the game. I know that that's sort of a delicate line for a lot of leagues, but some leaders in sports have said, you know, sure. the more people have riding on the game, the more likely they are to be very interested, even for 3 hours at a stretch.
Skin in the game, as it were. Rachel Bachman is a senior sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
About one of every 12 children in this country has asthma. Just about that many adults, too. Works out to about 8% of the whole population. So says the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC also points out that asthma also costs this economy more than $50 billion a year in medical expenses, lost school and work days, and early deaths. So in Tacoma, Washington, a group of moms has decided to take on the problem early. Eilish O'Neill reports.
When Gabriela Avendano's daughter was about to start kindergarten, she took her to the doctor for a cough that wouldn't go away.
Y dijo la doctora, no, esto es asma.
And the doctor said, your daughter doesn't have a cold. She has asthma. The doctor gave Avendano an inhaler and other medications, which Avendano brought to the nurse's office at her daughter's school.
It really surprised me to find that the shelves of the nurse's office were full of medication like my daughter's. And I said, oh, so this is a very normal problem here.
That got Avendano thinking about what she could do to help tackle the problem of asthma in the Latino community in the Tacoma area. The average medical cost for a person with asthma is about $3,300 per year. That's according to the CDC. But people with asthma can reduce their risk of asthma attacks by taking their medication and by getting rid of dust, mold, and other things that trigger asthma. Sally Findley is a public health researcher at Columbia University, and she says one way to tackle the problem is to look at daycare centers.
Children in daycare centers spend a lot of time there. So all of that time, they're being exposed to whatever triggers are still in the daycare center.
Findley says daycare providers want to have clean spaces, but don't always know how.
The same kinds of asthma triggers that exist in homes also exist in daycare centers. You can find cockroaches, you can find mold, blankies and bears could be the home for dust mites.
Findley says some cleaning products, like chlorine, can also trigger asthma. Armed with this kind of information, Avendano and 9 other moms from the Tacoma area decided to take on the problem of asthma triggers in daycares. They started by visiting small, unlicensed daycare centers and surveying their conditions. Elsa Trujillo is one of the moms.
One of the daycares I visited was really small, and the windows were always closed. At the end of the survey, we said, look, you have to open the windows every day for at least half an hour. And the cleaning products you use are also very important. They hadn't known these things. I think our advice helped.
In a trailer park southeast of Tacoma, a 2-year-old is building a house out of child-sized chairs and sheets of cardboard that are bigger than he is. This playhouse is inside a trailer home belonging to Araceli Martinez. Martinez takes care of 4 kids. She charges $3 an hour per child. Martina says when she first started running the daycare, she didn't know much about what could trigger an asthma attack.
You should wash sheets and stuffed animals regularly because they gather a lot of dust.
Martina says the moms taught her a lot about how to keep her house free of asthma triggers.
And it's better to use organic cleaning products. And if you use Clorox,
measure small amounts.
Public health researchers in New York and Florida have studied similar programs to train daycare providers there, and they found the programs reduced asthma hospitalizations among toddlers. The moms in Tacoma say they hope public health departments here will start their own asthma inspections and education for daycare providers so the program can scale up. In Tacoma, I'm Alicia O'Neill for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the I Do Not Like It, Sam I Am file. I'm not quite sure how I missed this, but Netflix, it seems, has a new show dropping this fall, a reinterpretation of the Dr. Seuss classic Green Eggs and Ham. Ellen DeGeneres produces the voices of Tracy Morgan, Diane Keaton, Michael Douglas, Alana Glazer, and David Diggs, among others, star. Here, though, is the thing I don't get. The book takes, what, like 5 minutes to read aloud, tops? Netflix, 13 episodes. All right, we are out of here. The Dow Industrial is up 63 points today, about 0.25%. NASDAQ basically flat. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, about 0.1% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostet, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.